This is The Light Inside. I'm Jeffrey Biesecker. Stories, they're everywhere. In our childhood and adult books, we read them as fables. Through advertising, they reinforce our beliefs about products. The news tells us what's happening in the world we inhabit. There are many theories as to why narratives have so much power. Just what makes storytelling so effective for gaining insight and creating effective learning? A story in many ways believed to establish connections both between people and ideas. Stories convey culture, history, and values. They're felt to unite people, often helping us see things in a new light. They help us to understand others and ourselves. Storytelling can often be a powerful force for creating a sense of place. This ability to learn from stories is a skill that keeps us focused as curious students throughout life. Yet there exists an often overlooked and sometimes dark side of story, one from which we form our biases and more narrowed judgments. In doing so, they become an altogether different form of reality. This is perhaps nowhere more evident than in our social personas. This is the story being examined today as we explore the role our social personas play on our perceptions of reality. When we return on The Light Inside. If you're like me, a child of the 70s, Paul Harvey was a regular household staple of television news. As a 14-year-old, growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Paul began his lifelong career in media as the cleanup boy at radio station KVOO. After rising through the ranks, Paul eventually stepped into the role of reading news and commercials on the air, going on to become a full-time newsman. In addition to his radio newscast during the Second World War, Paul shared a series titled The Rest of the Story on ABC Radio Networks, beginning on May 10, 1976. During this series, little-known or forgotten facts on a variety of subjects were shared, with some key elements of the story, usually the name of some well-known person, held back until the end. Paul would start each broadcast by saying, "You know what the news is. In a minute, you're going to hear the rest of the story." The broadcast always concluded with a variant of the tagline, "And now you know the rest of the story." Many of his radio stories were later published in book form as The Rest of the Story and also the book More of the Rest of the Story. True Mysteries from History, a quote which often appeared on the back cover of More of the Rest of the Story. There's a reason each episode of The Rest of the Story was unique. Each story had a unique twist and was verified to be true. Although it was often questioned the validity of that statement, but they were nevertheless entertaining. Our self-held beliefs and biases dictate how we see the world, so keeping true to our stories, framing how we see the world, is somewhat of a mystery. Traveling our way through this life are mental constructs often serving as a lens from which we view our circumstances and experiences. Our frames of reference, coloring how we each perceive things. Nowhere is this more true than as we view both our own personal journey and the story of others. You see, just like Paul Harvey's stories, many of our narratives are filtered, moderated, and often inaccurate, until further consideration is exercised and we reveal the rest of the story. Narratives sometimes interest researchers because they are thought to be connected to deeper structures of human existence. We dream a narrative, daydream a narrative, remember, anticipate, hope, despair, believe, doubt, plan, revise, criticize, construct, gossip, learn, hate, and even love by narrative. In this view, narratives play a fundamental role in structuring the human mind and rationality. Narratives allow us to try on future behavior, much as we can try on different shoes or suits before buying them. Today, we learn how our social personas are influenced by our perceptual identities. asking the question, how is it possible that I can see something as something from some time and that this something does not change its identity? This may seem like a strange question, but from a neurological point of view, perceptual identity is a great enigma. The activation of single neurons change their activities within milliseconds, whereas perceptual identity is maintained over much longer timeframes. We tend to take identity for granted, but it's not only a challenge of perception, it's also a central question for our emotions, our memories, our thoughts, our personal selves, and especially our intentions. In our ever-changing world, what makes a story true? It's the unruly openness of narrative analysis which makes it so rich. But to handle the diversity of the field, points of reference are needed. Researchers have suggested we should grapple with the two fundamental questions when conducting narrative analysis. The first question revolves around the status attributed to narrative. It is defined as the component of human existence or as merely a representational device. Emphasizing one answer over the other means mobilizing different theories of representation. Therefore, suggesting different formulas between narrative and reality. Is seeing actually believing? This brings us to our second question, referring to the perspective developed on narrative. Is it defined mostly as the characteristic of something, an object for investigation, or perhaps incidentally, both? The reality and truth of a narrative are different and run parallel to the reality of experience. These truths don't reveal the past as it actually was, aspiring to a standard of objectivity. They give us instead the truths of our experience. Unlike the truth of scientific ideal, the truths of our personal narratives are neither open to proof nor self-evident. We come to understand them only through the interpretation, many of which are simply myth, as filtered through our personal biases. In The Myth-Guided Mind, author Michael Hayes delivers a powerful proposition. We're not nearly as broken as the devices we use to make us well. With a success rate of around 20%, conventional therapy tactics turn us towards false answers and away from what we need most. Truth. Hines asserts that healing techniques such as somatics, coupled with a reconnection to allegories, create a state where we often hide the keys to our happiness, and in plain sight, freeing them will lead us home. Michael believes we need to access these same old stories to stop repeating the same old stories, to uncover what is known as motivated thinking. Michael, what is motivated thinking?
This whole concept of, you know, motivation or motivated thinking, and they're quite different. It's like, how do we get curious? I think you're onto it already. And, you know, maybe we'll just kind of push this a little more. I love that we're doing this co-creating thing. This is fun for me, right? How about this? So, you know, in terms of motivated thinking, it's when we are completely fixed inside a story, and it's usually a collective story. And we've got a set of beliefs, and our actions are dictated by those set of beliefs, and we're basically unaware of it. And then we go out, but with our curiosity, rather than being scientific, we just find essentially evidence that proves our preconceptions. And it's all over the place. And it goes into, you know, our sports teams, our political parties and who we vote for. It goes into our social groups. We kind of just, by default, stay with what we like, what keeps us comfortable. And again, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense. Survival is based on staying inside a group, and brain is very expensive to pull ourselves out of, you know, that, that basic automatic thinking and push ourselves into using brain energy to actually question some of these things costs calories. So we don't want to do it. We want to stay in the automatic by default. You know, in the coaching world and in kind of what we're doing here in this podcast, we're asking some of these harder questions like, okay, what if we get curious? Is this really how the world is? Am I just playing into a social persona? If I am, I should be able to take, you know, that lab coat off or that suit off and put on my comfy clothes later and feel myself differently. Like, how do I get outside of that and see what else is, you know, really at me that's beneath all of these stories? Because there is, well, I mean, again, you know, you're going to run into other people say no, but I'm on the side of there is some kind of an essence that we each have. And I think that we can get into creating stories that, like, we're always doing that. We're constantly creating meaning. But if we can drop the persona, if we can get curious and really check into what the landscape is, not the landscape of 30, 40, 50 years ago, the one right now, there's a ton of potential there.
I think that very notion you mentioned of putting on that comfy coat is a very kind of embattled sometimes social construct we face. That notion of whether or not we're comfortable or uncomfortable. I want to kind of lean as a hanging thought today. It's not necessarily our goal today to unravel that one. I'd like to turn our attention, if we might, to why social constructs might be formed and created as we experience our interactions.
Well, I mean, we do have to kind of survive in this world and live for the moment and all those things. And our brain is constantly making things automatic. So if you look at kind of Lisa Feldman Barrett, she describes this as she's a head neuroscientist catching lots and lots of positive reviews and very popular these days. But she's saying, hey, our body is constant. Our brain is that part of the body that's constantly budgeting for the future. And that includes how much brain energy we're spending. So if we can make something automatic, even automatic with a little bit of practice, including who we talk to and how we talk to them, and we can bring it to kind of close to zero cost, then we're going to. Our survival has depended on it. We technically live in a world that you can have, you know, abundance. Everybody, probably listeners on the podcast, we're all living in that world where we're not going to run out of energy, as it were, from food and shelter and so on. But we are wired to form these social constructs, and then it becomes part of our personality. And we don't check them periodically, do a little spring cleaning, then we kind of convince ourselves that this is me. And we can convince other people and pigeonhole them, or they can pigeonhole us. It's like, oh, hey, that's Jeffrey. He's this great podcaster. There's nothing else to Jeffrey, right? Well, that's Mike. You know what I mean? He's this guy up in Canada. He does some guesting and some coaching. Yeah, that's it, right? And we got these little social constructs, and they're cheap and easy and basically effective. They're low cost.
I want to look at that notion of the social construct and the very definition of it. It says that humans create constructs in order to make sense of the objective world. Yet so frequently, why is it that we shift that goal of objectivity as we make sense of this journey? And why do we often form very subjective, distorted views of what we feel and perceive?
Well, this is going to get into the nature of objectivity and subjectivity, and A, does it exist? But, my kind of reflex reaction, and not me as the professional, is saying, I don't do that. I make objective calls on the world. I am doing it. You might be doing the subjective over there. My flaws and your motivations. And so we start making some of these attribution errors. We start, falling into some of these biases, even at the nature of bringing up this conversation. So we like to think that I am this clever, unbiased, objective creature that doesn't do that kind of subjective motivated thinking with, particularly ulterior motives, where I'm some sort of nefarious thing behind the background that I've kind of got this social persona, over the top of. And it is to kind of make sure we can sleep at night, really, right? So this idea of objectivity is a little blurry as soon as we start, pulling apart a social construct. It's like, really, are any of us objective? Or do we have more of, say, a different subjectivity, the way we have in the world of expertise? So I don't have a wine tasting expertise, but there are people who are sommeliers. So I might say, hey, what's the best bottle of wine here? Now, if I trusted that person, I'm very likely to trust them, and they have an expertise. It's still subjective, but they can give a whole list of reasons for why their subjective is better than my subjective. And it takes me out of that kind of adversarial of like, no, my objective is really for real and yours is subjective. It takes us out of those kind of entrenched stories. Is that making sense where we're going here?
I'm looking at this aspect, and immediately this notion of tool time and Tim Allen comes into play, comes into mind, in the neighbor Wilson.
who always seems to be there in the right moment, yep, looking over the fence to give Tim wise sage advice.
Yeah.
How often are we playing those roles where we're looking over the fence? And how might we be more like Wilson, who seems to be somewhat more objective about it?
Yeah. And I tell you, if we get into some kind of arrangement, we have a very good friend or we're employing somebody for that purpose. I mean, a mentor in the right office place, of course, but a therapist, a coach, like somebody who's not got any skin in the game, as it were, of how our life is going, tends to be able to be much more objective. So, you know, we aren't having, as that observer, as that character, what was his name on the other side of the fence?
It's Wilson.
Wilson, pull him back.
It's been a while, but it's still such a very relevant reference to me in that regard. So often as we're looking over that fence, so to speak. Yeah.
But if I'm here and I'm in the middle of, I need this thing, I need this tool, I need this, whatever it can be, relationship, job. I mean, there's a whole list of them, car, status. We're in a state of need. We're probably, you know, not so in touch with our highest self in that moment. We're much more in our desperation and in our hunger, right? Which is a good thing as long as we're kind of, you know, in tune with it. And if someone says, hey, you know what? You don't need a screwdriver. You need a hammer. Here, try it. Like, they're going to seem like a genius to us, but they're not all wrapped up in us, you know, kind of failing at what we're doing with the tools we're trying to do it with and getting angry when we really need to get it done. And, you know, that is us caught deep in our subjectivity and having, you know, basically the prefrontal cortex turned off, as what happens in trauma or any heightened state of emotion, get way over into the subjective.
And so often as we're kicking into that subjective view, we're simply picking up perhaps an incorrect tool, I will say, not necessarily wrong, because that becomes a judgment in and of itself, but an incorrect tool to gauge and measure how we see things. Social illusion comes to mind. We form our own constructs of what we believe to be true. And not only do we measure ourselves by this form of false yardstick, we do it to evaluate and judge others as well.
Yeah. And, you know, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners already know, we tend to evaluate others harshly and assign these value judgments to their character. Like, this is who this person is, rather than, you know, I made a mistake, right? And so, you know, so in that situation where, you know, somebody scratches our car accidentally in the parking lot, they're an evil person. I was on the other side of that story, and I'm trying to pull my daughter out of the back seat and I accidentally, you know, bump the car door and it bumps into them. Like, that's a mistake. And I'm sorry, I might leave a little note, but I mean, that's a mistake. It's not who I am as a person. But we do make this error when we're looking at other people where we kind of assign that as who they are. This is their identity. They're evil. They ruined my baby. You know, like, how could they do this to me? We get into that kind of thought process. And unless we can catch that, and it becomes particularly important, say, in a workplace, unless we can catch those things and have ways to navigate ourselves out of those, you know, very negative stories and that kind of distorted thinking, we can get into it like a toxic work environment or maybe not toxic, but at least some kind of negative process where, a whole lot more is potential. But it does mean we've got to take a breath and say, all right, what else could be happening? Is there a conversation I could have with this person? Can I test my reality in the here and now, or after I had time to cool off, depending how how heated it is for us?
Much has been written about cognitive biases in the last decade. Walking into the psychology section, Barnes & Noble, or browsing Amazon for decision-making, you're sure to see a library of books detailing how irrational humans can be. Many cognitive biases affect humans in their everyday actions, like confirmation bias or overconfidence. In thinking, however, the most important and troubling mistake is the fundamental attribution error. Cognitive biases such as these often shape how an individual interacts and engages the world around them. In our daily social interactions, understanding these biases and becoming aware of the ways they influence our behavior is vital. Just what is the fundamental attribution error? The fundamental attribution error refers to an individual's tendency to attribute others' actions to their character or personality, while attributing their own behavior to external situational factors outside of their control. In other words, you tend to cut yourself a break while holding others 100% accountable for their actions. For instance, if you've ever chastised a lazy employee for being late to a meeting and then proceeding to make an excuse for being late yourself, you've made the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error exists because of how people perceive the world. While you have at least some idea of your own character, motives, and situational factors that affect your day-to-day, you rarely know everything that's going on with someone else. Similar to confirmation and overconfidence biases, it detrimentally impacts our everyday lives. Each of us slips into our own patterns of conditional thinking. So as we consider when this is beyond our control, it is only then we can potentially influence our own thinking, then surrendering the need to judge others. Considering the effects of fundamental attribution, this leads us to underestimate the influence of situational factors on people's behavior, shaping what might result from overestimating the aspect of a person's personality. Michael, upon considering this, might we frequently tend to overgeneralize a person's character based on these assumptions? Say, for instance, if we perceive someone to be angry, we assume they are automatically an angry person, rather than considering if they might have experienced an unpleasant situation then felt an emotional reactive response to it. Might this lead to us making broad sweeping evaluations which simply stigmatize the character of those we encounter?
That's absolutely kind of perfect because, you know, when we get triggered that way, when we are reactive, when we're no longer thinking clearly. And we all have these kinds of things. And anger is kind of the easy one to figure out. But I mean, it can be jealousy in a relationship. It can be sadness over loss. Like there are just times when, you know, legally and otherwise, we recognize we're not in our right minds. And we want to catch it when you know, we do, not when it's too late and somebody else has to catch it for us. It's like, hey, man, you're way offside right now. In sports, you know, it's like hockey, so you've got 2 minutes, you're in the box because you did something stupid based on your emotions rather than what was needed in the play. It's harder for us to think about going through my day and I can get triggered in the very same way. And, you know, if we're doing it well, then we're going to say, hey, maybe I'm passionate about this suddenly and I'm really going to drive this point home and be emotional about it. And it's going to be positive, or I'm going to bring joy to this experience. It's going to be positive. Those aren't the ones we're talking about. Those ones, sure, they can put some people off, but 90% of the time, they're going to be positive experiences. When we kind of fall into some of the things that we call more negative, our thinking process is narrow. And basically, our creativity is turned off, our curiosity is turned off, and we get into more of like a witch hunt mentality where we're going to find all evidence to prove our case. And then we're even going to kind of, you know, solicit and possibly employ other people to prove our case as well. Yeah. So we're going to collect a bunch of allies to prove that, you know, that guy's a jerk. I mean, look what he did to me. And we can go on for days and days and days and weeks and years talking about, say, the scratch on the car. And I can't believe that happened to me. And, you know, taking up all that time with our friends and our family. And again, like that can be our personality. And yet we are just kind of missing a very simple choice of, hey, I had a reaction. I was triggered emotionally. What else might be true? And how can I verify, A, if it even matters? I mean, you know, it's a couple hundred bucks, fix a dent, you know, fix this paint scratch, right? Like there's some sunk time cost that, you know, we can really invest in and really stay attached to, you know. Or we can just say, hey, I need that other person right now. Help me out. Give me an objective reality. Like with what just happened with me there is like, how much time is this going to cost me? Like, I haven't got that kind of time for something that's that much money, or I really don't. I'm a busy guy and like, I gotta get this off of my plate and stop being angry about it and start and start getting what matters.
So that notion of that witch hunt mentality jumps forward to me, making broad sweeping evaluations which stigmatize the character of those we encounter. To me, I'm shifting with that again in my mind. I like to find these story narratives that are very representative of that to us. You know, we talk about finding that time-based answer, the Wizard of Oz. Which witch are we choosing to listen to, the good witch or the bad witch? Judgment in and of itself can become a slippery slope. And in regards to that, what becomes effective and what becomes limiting? So much can be learned from that simple narrative of the Wizard of Oz that I feel we could write a book, maybe entitled The 101 Valuable Lessons from the Wizard of Oz, about our character and how we see the world.
Yeah.
Stories about our courage, stories about what we feel is our home or our spiritual center. And then again, simply those stories about how we see and view the world. Absolutely. All can be learned from that one simple fable. How we create that meaning is up to us. Let's look at sometimes how not knowing how we view ourselves inside limits how we see those on the outside, or our perception of those on the outside. Maybe leaning into the notion of introspect illusion as that comes to mind.
Yeah, my favorite exchange there, and I may not have it right, is Dorothy confronts the wizard and, "You're a really bad person." He says, "No, I'm just a bad wizard. I'm a good person." And it unties that little piece there. It's like, well, okay, he was a sham. He was a fraud. You know, you pull away that curtain and he's just a guy who had a very elaborate social construct up around him. I mean, that's fun. That's pure gold for, like, you pull away that curtain. It's like,
little the light inside shine. You know, what light are we shining inward then to examine that under? Are we hiding behind the shadow of the curtain? Are we allowing that glory that's inside of us to simply shine outward?
And I love that kind of, yeah, I believe it's a modern fable, as you said. Like, yeah. It actually has that key of like, hey, what is this deep spirituality? What is this light that I'm meant to be sharing with the world? What is my genius and how do I share it freely? And, you know, when we get back to Kansas, it's we're a different person. Like, we've actually traveled that journey, right? And this is, I think that's what I was kind of hinting at earlier, is like, this is storytelling. It opens up possibilities, not turns into all kinds of limiting beliefs where we get stuck.
As we turn this lens towards others, we base our views in assumptions and often expectations, all being influenced by our perceptive biases. What role does introspection illusion have as we view our circumstances and situations? Being attuned to our innermost feelings, thoughts, and beliefs. For instance, what forms our core values? And do we have an understanding of how societal conditioning has shaped those views? How objective are we when we uncover our deeper stories? Or perhaps we frequently err towards personal myth. Our limiting beliefs often leaving us feeling stuck and unsure throughout life. The tales we tell hold powerful sway over our memories, behaviors, and even identities. According to research from the burgeoning field of narrative psychology, storytelling isn't just how we construct our identities. The stories we tell very often become our identities. A point we will soon illustrate with our next guest, Dr. Sharon Grossman. As an executive coach to those who identify as high achievers, Sharon relays how clinging to these identities can often lead to burnout and self-sabotage. Instead, showing us how we can avoid these cycles and end the anxiety often associated with achievement when we return. I want to share a little secret with you today about a podcast booking and matching platform I truly love. As a podcast host and guest, my go-to podcast booking app is podmatch.com. If you currently have a podcast, regularly guest on podcast, or if you are new to the podcasting game looking to start your show, podmatch.com is an industry leader. They quickly and effortlessly connect ideal podcast guests and hosts. Their process is super easy and highly effective. Create your free guest or host account and set up your profile. It's really that easy. And the PodMatch AI will work its magic in the background, delivering your ideal interview matches within minutes, tailored uniquely for you. As a host and executive producer of the top 100 self-improvement podcast, The Light Inside, I found more high-quality guests on PodMatch than anywhere else and in a fraction of the time. So if you're looking to expedite your podcast booking experience, filling your calendar with high-engagement content, creating value and meaning for your listening community, check out podmatch.com, that's podmatch.com today, and discover your ideal match magic. Dr. Dan McAdams is a Northwestern University psychology professor who has spent the past decade systematically and quantitatively studying stories. When people turn episodes from their lives into antecedents, McAdams asserts it's not just to entertain their friends. Stories allow us to make sense of otherwise puzzling or random events. Stories help us smooth out some of the decisions we have made in creating something that is meaningful and sensible out of the chaos that is our lives. Researchers have found our stories can also shape our future. It's particularly important to tell stories of struggle that turn out well, since this may inspire people to live more productive lives. And stories that vividly describe turmoil seem to help people grow wiser in the aftermath of major life challenges. The power of narrative, however, isn't always positive. Many theories exist explaining how our personal biases and limiting beliefs often leave us feeling stuck and unsure throughout life. Perhaps pointing to how, if we're unsure and insecure in how we view ourselves, are we then able to relate to others more selflessly? Do we see others for who they are, or might we be tempted to mold them into our own expectations? Taken together, psychologists' narrative research makes one resounding point. We don't just tell stories. Stories tell us. They shape our thoughts and memories and even change how we live our lives. Storytelling isn't just how we construct our identities. Those stories, very often, are our identities. York University psychology professor Ian McGregor found that when providing students with an ambiguous story about a breakup, then asking them to tell a slanted version placing the blame on just one of the parties, the students then beginning to make up stories which fit their own beliefs. Even after rereading the ambiguous story script, the students still said the person they previously championed was relatively innocent. 40 weeks after the initial study, the participants had forgotten almost every detail of the vignette. But still, they felt they knew with whom to place the blame. Stories shape memory so dramatically, claims McGregor, once you tell a story, it's hard to get out of that story's framework, as they tend to get more dramatic over time. To what might we attribute this? A psychological phenomena known as implicit cues. This being one of our greatest examples of the fundamental attribution error. One notable example of the fundamental attribution error appears in the first study that focused on this phenomenon, published in 1967 by Edward Jones and Victor Harris, two researchers at Duke University. In the first and best known of the experiments, participants were given what they thought was an essay written by a student for a political science exam on a very controversial topic, Fidel Castro's Cuba. Some participants of the study receiving a pro-Castro essay, and others an anti-Castro one. And they were all asked to judge the true attitude of the essay written toward the topic. The experiment provided evidence of the fundamental attribution error, since participants who read the pro-Castro essay were significantly more likely to assume that the student who wrote it were themselves pro-Castro, compared to those who read the anti-Castro essay, even when they were told that the student who wrote the essay had no choice with regard to the topic. These findings were replicated in a follow-up experiment where participants read what they thought was an initial draft of an opening statement of a college debate on that same topic. Since then, other researchers found evidence of the fundamental attribution error in various domains. For instance, additional examples of the fundamental attribution error include the following. People watching TV shows often display the fundamental attribution error when they attribute the behavior of the actors to their own personality, rather than the script. We can witness this especially when people sometimes assume that an actor's behavior while in character reflects their true personality, rather than what is dedicated for them by the script. Furthermore, this effect has been shown to maintain consistent even when the person displaying the fundamental attribution error watches the same actor playing two different roles. In such cases, the last thing that people view is generally the one that determines their evaluation of the actor's general character as a human being in real life. We can also witness this phenomena when students often display the fundamental attribution error as they overestimate internal causes of their teacher's expression of anger. Essentially, this means that students assume that the main reason why their teachers are angry is that they are angry people, rather than that their environment has caused the teacher to become angry. This remains the case even when students recognize their own actions, such as misbehavior, intentional provoking, or lack of effort, or what causes the teacher to initially become angry in the first place. Implicit social cues playing an essential role in forming our evaluations of situational factors, often leading to fundamental attribution error. These social cues are verbal or nonverbal signs expressed through the face, body, voice, motion, and guiding conversations, as well as other social interactions, by influencing our impressions and responses towards others. The ability to perceive social signals and integrate them into our judgments about others' intentional mind states, as observed in our beliefs, desires, emotions, or knowledge, is often referred to as the theory of mind or mentalization, and from calculated estimates, is already evident in infants as early as 18 months of age. This perhaps begs us to question, do we distinguish between what we think is true and what we can understand as factual and proven data? And furthermore, what often hinders us from seeing a more objective and expansive view of the world around us, especially as we consider the personas of other people? Does bias, blind spot, discrepancy frequently influence our perceptions, swaying how we see others? Many of these blind spots surfacing as expectations, leading to the formation of such emotional reactive states as contempt, envy, or jealousy. A function of what is known as social comparison. As human beings, why do we often see the grass as being greener on the other side? In order to get a clearer picture, we asked Dr. Sharon Grossman to discuss how we might be turning a blind eye to the role persona plays in adopting the conditioned label of overachiever. The core of this state being a sense of identity based on our conditioned beliefs determining our sense of value and purpose. Sharon, from your experience and perspective, what is at the root of our outward need to be validated and in most senses substantiated by such an identity?
So you're looking to figure out how our culture is potentially contributing to our overachievement or a tendency to work too hard, which can bring about burnout. And here's what I would say about that. I think there's definitely an element of truth in that, but I also think that it's kind of an interesting thing that we are attracted to certain environments where those environments have the expectations, or certain people that we gravitate toward have a similar format or expectation of how we should show up, which matches our programming. In other words, there's this subconscious piece to the puzzle here that we may not even be aware of. And what that means is that when you are programmed to think a certain way, you end up showing up a certain way and gravitating toward those work environments or relationships where that expectation is a match. So I'll give you an example just to put this into context, okay? So I have a podcast called Decode Your Burnout. And one of the things that we talk about there when people come on and share their burnout story is how there are these three different contributing factors to their burnout. So the first one is programming, which I just mentioned. The second is environmental stressors, which could be the culture at your work, as you're talking about. And the third one is your personality. And I just released an episode actually this week with a woman who mentioned that she was, get this, pregnant with her third child, going through medical residency, and at that time, working 120 hours a week. Can you imagine? Right. And so as we started to peel back the onion and figure out, like, I can't even imagine working 120 hours when I'm single and not pregnant, let alone having two kids and one in my belly, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And so I'm like, what in the world was going on there? And certainly there is that expectation when you're in residency to put in a lot of hours, but there was something even deeper. And for her, as she talks about it, it's the inability to set boundaries. And so we're like, okay, but where did that come from?
From that perspective, do you think perhaps this is rooted in our outward need to be validated and in most senses, substantiated by our identity?
Well, it came from her childhood where her parents had these expectations of her being perfect and her contributing. And she talked about how they would go to church every Sunday. And the idea of church was that you have to serve. And so there's this whole thing that kind of got baked inside of her, which was, I need to work really hard and I need to serve in order for me to be worthy. And if I can't for one reason or another, then I'm not worthy. Now, it's not a rational, logical sort of situation, right? It's basically like, it doesn't matter how much I'm already doing. If at any point I have to say, no, I can't take on another thing because, you know, I am 9 months pregnant or because I have two other kids at home or I've already put in 100 hours. If at any point you have to say no to anything or anyone, your self-worth automatically drops. And she even talked about how when she was in college, she stopped going to church, not for all the reasons you might think, but because she was working so hard, she didn't have any more to give. And she felt like she doesn't have a right to sit at the table if she can't show up to church in order to serve. She was not privileged, quote unquote, enough to go to church because she couldn't serve. So there's so much in the way that we're programmed to think about ourselves, our productivity, our self-worth that contributes to this. And then certainly if you have that sort of programming, you are more likely to seek out those kinds of work situations that match, right? Because they want you to give and you want to give. And it's just like a perfect blend of the two.
That harkens back to me to that notion of what you think you attract. To me, that relates to what is known as social constructionism. That's hearkening then again to that idea. Certain facts of our existence, our environment, are influenced by what we believe that reality itself to be. You know, that reality that in order to be in that achievement mode, in order to be worthy, in order to validate those expectations of others, we're leaning toward those shared ways of thinking, those shared beliefs, those ideas that in order for me to fit in and be accepted as who I am are governed by that identity to a large degree. Would you agree?
Yes. And I think it's also important to understand that sometimes it's not even our own mind that's coming up with these ideas. It's the influence of our environment, right? So if you're growing up in a house where the parents are expecting you to always get A's, and she talks about this. She says, if I ever got a B, the question was always, why didn't you get an A? Yeah. Right. So when we're conditioned to think about perfectionism and all of these things about working hard, I've had clients talk about burnout because they have such a strong work ethic. Where did that come from? Seeing their parents kill themselves every single day working long hours, right? So sometimes it's because other people have these ideas and they just rubs off on us. And it could also potentially be that you just are influenced by your peers or by your work environment. So when you go into a place like medical school and there is that expectation that you're just going to be showing up and working around the clock and giving it your all, everybody's doing that. That's the culture there. Even if you didn't have that programmed into you before, by the time you get out of there, it's programmed in.
In this regard, you know, it would seem salience and introspection play a role in uncovering the foundational cause of this this kind of disassociation. In many regards, this existential crisis is very similar to what I can relate to as interrelationship. Although this is typically considered a state between two or more people, can this state potentially exist as each of us consider our own levels of identification?
Okay, so I mentioned that one of the contributing factors is our personality. And so the way that I talk about that is that there are three burnout profiles or personalities that are the ones that tend to burn out the most. So the first one is the thinker. Those are people who are very much stuck in their head. They've got a lot of negative thoughts. It's kind of that inner voice is constantly criticizing them. There's very little self-compassion in that sort of schema, if you will. There's an expectation for things to be perfect. And there's a lot of anxiety that happens as a result of things not being in their control. Control is something that's very important to them because that's how they can make things the way that they need to be. You know, these are people that tend to think in a very black and white way. So we have all these constructions in our mind of how things should be and how when we don't have things in that way, it creates a lot of anxiety. And over time, all of the stress that builds up can become burnout because we're driving ourselves really hard. I worked with another one of my VIP clients who had this perfectionistic tendency. And she came to me burned out, feeling really resentful about her industry, her job. And what it turned out to be is that she has perfectionistic tendencies. And as a result of that, she was working extra hours. Not because her industry required it, not because her job gave her too much to do in the time that she had, but because the way that she was showing up to work with that expectation of having everything be perfect took a lot longer to get the work done. And so what that meant is that she had to come in early and stay late, and that translated into less recovery time after work and so much resentment about when you don't understand that you're the cause of what's happening, right? Then you're looking for external explanations of why am I working so much? And it took her a little while to kind of figure out that it was really coming from her. So that's really an example of the thinker, but it can also look like imposter syndrome and people who, I have one client who would take 6, 7, 8 times reading every single email before she pressed send because she was so terrified of maybe making some sort of mistake in that email. And then if she would send it out, everybody would quote unquote figure it out that
yes,
she doesn't belong there, that she has no right to be there. And so talk about your work just taking a lot longer than it really needs to. If you eliminate those additional 7 checks of your every email, you can get your work done in probably like a quarter of the time, right? So these are the kinds of things that the thinkers tend to burn out over. And it's not a one-time thing, right? It's part of your personality. So this is how you're showing up every single day. And it creates a lot of angst. The second type is what I call the feeler. Those are your people pleasers. These are people who are your nurturers and they want to take care of everybody. So their heart's in the right place, but they put themselves on the back burner. They are so filled with guilt about saying no to other people. That's why they don't have any boundaries in place and they take on too much. And it's very similar to that first client that I shared about who was working all these hours. The reason she put in 120 hours before going in for delivery is because she was worried that while she was going to be gone, all of this work would be on somebody else's shoulders. She didn't want to burden someone else with all of the work that she, quote unquote, should be doing. And so she was trying to compensate for that. And it didn't matter that she had needs. It didn't matter that, you know, she was exhausted. She wasn't sleeping. The only thing that matters is what other people's experience is going to be and what her mind told her she should be doing, right? So when you have a lot of shoulds in your life, you end up doing a lot of things that maybe you don't want to do. You really burn yourself out. You become really resentful when other people don't reciprocate in the same way. And so you're stuck in this pattern of a lot of negativity. And finally, I have what I call the doer. Those are your overachievers who really push themselves very hard, not because they feel guilty about other people and not because their mind tells them that they aren't doing a good enough job, but it's more this idea of I'm not doing enough. And that comes from a belief that I'm not enough. And so if it's this internal void that I have, I'm looking externally to fill it. And the problem with that model is that no matter how much I do, it's never really going to be enough, because then we're done with that task or achieved that goal. And then we're on to the next thing. It's like, you can never really arrive. You're never done. So that's for certain a burnout model that a lot of people struggle with. And from listening to people's stories and how burnout has manifested for them, I find that those are the people that burn out the hardest, because even when their body is breaking down and they find themselves hospitalized multiple times, their hair is falling out, like everything is just crumbling, they still push. They still push. They still feel like they can't let go. They can't stop. They can't like relent, right? Because they have that programming that they have to constantly do and go. And it's just absolutely exhausting.
In that regard, to me, it would seem that we're getting caught in that act of rumination and how that then leads to being caught up in the notion of validating our own suffering, that then becoming our kind of shadow form of identity, that suffering itself forming its own persona.
So if you think back to the three different personality types that I just mentioned, what did you hear with regards to that shadow self coming out?
To me, is when we're looking at that from a very objective, non-biased experience, it's more rooted in whether or not we're feeling some form of validation, whether or not we're living up to some degree of expectation.
I would agree with that. I think that is very much at the root of a lot of our behavior, is we're seeking that. And everybody seeks it for a different reason or in a different way. But ultimately, I think that's what we're really after. That's part of our core needs that maybe don't get filled in other places. And so we gravitate towards work and our relationships sometimes in order to feel that. And so the problem with that is that we're externalizing the opportunity to get that need met. And that is never going to work out long term. It works in the short term, but that's what keeps you as a work junkie, if you will, right? Because you have to keep coming back and doing more and doing more and doing more in order to feel that validation. And sometimes it doesn't work out. If you're the perfectionist and you can't make it perfect.
We often think of our biases as something we use in our judgments of others. But can these biases also be a lens filtering the view and limiting how we see ourselves? Being our best can often feel like a struggle, yet we often do struggle to see the best in each other. Our foundational attribution errors, creating incorrect assumptions in how we evaluate others, as those around us and those we see in both the media and social circles thrive, feelings of envy often arise. We frequently question why they seem to be reaching their objectives while feeling our own sense of struggle or falling behind. As a result, we look to cut them down. Why is it so hard, then, to celebrate the happiness and success of others? Are the judgments we make this far skewered? Why, then, in our vain envy, do we seek to cut others down? Our subjective biases getting in the way. What we think we know about each other often shaping the way we also feel. We seek wisdom in the most unlikely of places. In the immortal words of the Scandinavian pop group from the 70s, ABBA. Knowing me, knowing you is perhaps the best we can do. When we return to the light inside, we'll discover how a common social phenomena known as tall poppy syndrome is cutting others down to the knees. What's the key to a happy and fulfilling life?
I think it's the fear of showing up in our purity and our truth. We fear the light.
That's what I feel like this whole journey has brought me to.
Oftentimes, the things that we think will make us happy will not bring us safety and security.
At the end of the day, we are a sovereign, energetic being who has all the tools already on the inside.
It is within your fingertips. You can create the life that you want. And the only person that is stopping you from creating that life is you.
Our greatest transformation happens from deep within. We're all on the journey to discover the light inside, that beacon which guides us to live our truest, most authentic self. Visit us at www.thelightinside.us to find out more. In scientific research, human behavior is a complex interplay of three components: actions, cognition, and emotions. All believed to be united in a somewhat unified swirl of interactions. As we venture to meet our aspirations, sometimes we are met with people who feel we're undeserving of recognition. Deservingness is a field that includes a study of how people's concerns for justice develop over time. In this regard, deservingness is defined in terms of response to a perceived success or failure. In his Paramount study on achievement and worthiness, social psychologist Norman T. Feathers considered factors influencing perceived deservingness to positive or negative outcomes. Feathers then asserting how deservingness seems to develop in two main ways: how we each prioritize personal value, and then in considering the positive or negative evaluations given by others. Appraisal theory is a concept in psychology which introjects our emotions are extracted from our evaluations of events, causing specific reactions in different people. Essentially, our appraisal of how a situation causes an emotional or affective response, given based on these evaluations and expectations. Emotions play a large role in shaping what we perceive as our worldview, sometimes felt as a reaction to both our circumstances and situations. As we witness the trials, tribulations, and ultimately the perceived successes or failures of others, we often feel we might be missing out on something more, innately better. The ego leaving us feeling somewhat left behind. A mixed bag of feelings surfacing, such as anxiety, awe, disgust, envy, fear, joy, admiration, nostalgia, pain, and sometimes sadness or self-hostility. In essence, we beat ourselves up for what we feel we may be lacking. So if emotional experience is an ever-changing process, a river rather than a collection of pools, why have most theorists from Aristotle to Eichmann and most ordinary people thought of emotions as discrete categories? Open-ended descriptions of emotion are richer, but they also raise problems for researchers because what people say or write includes many ways of describing feelings going beyond the labels that we usually use. In our struggle to assign meaning, coming up with analogies, often saying things such as, "It was as though I had cheated," or "It was like being betrayed." They describe situations. "When I walked in, everyone stopped talking. My friend was crying uncontrollably, and I didn't know why. I wasn't paying attention, and oh my God, there was a tree right there in front of me." They use many words for emotion that are outside of scientific research, such as I felt stupid, appreciated, insecure, wowed, ineffective, insulted, ignored, and sometimes undeserving. But when we come to analyze this data, typically we code these labels into our usual emotion categories, sacrificing its richness and insidiously perpetuating the categorical point of view. Even theorists who completely reject the idea of basic emotions and categorical distinctions use emotion categories in their research for lack of a superior alternative. As others succeed, why do we then seem to take gleeful delight in chopping them down? Doug Garland has been studying the tall poppy phenomena for over 10 years, after having experienced it firsthand in his own career. His career brings awareness to an unknown, often recognized, and perhaps misunderstood human condition. Doug, let's start with the obvious question. Just what is tall poppy syndrome?
So just a tall poppy is anybody who has achieved some form of success, whether it's hard work or intellect or, you know, athletically, Hollywood, it's anyone with prestige. And to a certain extent, even if you inherit it, you inherit that prestige. So that's the so-called tall poppy in America. It's sort of working towards that America dream and achieving it. And that puts you in your neighborhood. And then there's sort of a neighborhood envy of wanting to be the best even in your own neighborhood or your workplace or your school or whatever. The metaphor itself then means seeing a field of tall poppies and then seeing somebody taller than the rest and wanting to cut that person down so that all the poppies are equal. So in your neighborhood, if somebody's too fancy for the rest of the group, then an active manner would be if he had a Porsche to scratch his car or key his car or something. But the more passive way is to disparage his activities and lifestyle to the rest of the neighbors.
And that could tend to have such a normalizing effect in some regards, or a stigmatizing effect. There's a lot of ways that could be looked at. You know, we each, I feel, want to feel that validity or sense of worth in what we're doing and what we're achieving. You know, we want to feel at our core valued for who we are.
No, that's exactly it. You're right. I mean, we all want recognition. I mean, it's part of the meaning of the search for life. But certainly a big part of that is validation. And when you don't get that, it does bruise your ego. I consider envy one of the most important emotions because it's always on. I mean, first thing when you came on this morning, I made a little bit of a judgment of you. I just compared you to myself, for example. So as soon as you don't get that validation, you have two options. You have the option of, why am I not being validated? You should look in at yourself. And why am I not being some soul searching? And why am I not being validated? And for some reason, if you feel you're good and they don't understand you, then you want to cut them down to make yourself feel more validated instead of saying, well, maybe I'm not the best neighbor, and trying to improve yourself. So you have two roads to take, so to speak. And the tall poppy syndrome, unfortunately, is usually taking the wrong road.
And that can be, to me, such an outwardly projected state. That sense of needing that validation from another, to me, signals that also we have that need to question those beliefs in ourselves, to reflect inward.
Yes, I mean, that's the whole problem with the internet and the selfies and things like that. You're looking for self-validation. I mean, you go out to lunch, you don't even consider it, but you're eating. All you're concerned about is taking that photo and sending it to your friends for self-validation. If you go to a restaurant, nobody's talking to each other. Nobody's really eating and enjoying the food. They're all just taking pictures and on their cell phone, looking for that self-validation and trying to get affirmation. So I consider the internet to, in many ways, the social media internet to be one big envy machine. It's sort of the currency that drives our internets.
Now, it's interesting to look at where our mind might be with that, our intention. You know, what are we inwardly signaling as we reach to share those things? You know, do we feel at times we want to share that experience with others to also signal how we appreciate that outwardly to the world? You know, I appreciate this great meal. Therefore, I would like to share that excitement with others. I think that can be a dual role sometimes.
It is. It is a duel between just what you mentioned, that the whole emotional state is a duel. So what are you really trying to share the joy, and you want the meal is so good here that you want your friends to see it and what a lovely experience, and maybe you too will want to come here. Unfortunately, I think the wrong message goes to the majority of people, triggering bad envy, that you're, in the old-fashioned days, sort of showing off, so to speak. Yeah. How cool am I? Look at me.
That's a good one to sit and ponder. That act of envy being, to me, one of those core causes in this circumstance. Let's dig a little deeper, if we might, to looking at what is believed to be those many core causes leading up to that triggering point of tall poppy syndrome.
Well, the largest number, scientifically, when you look at the literature, the biggest cutters are people with low self-esteem. And part of my research has been what causes low self-esteem. Are you familiar with adverse childhood experiences?
Yes.
So this, unfortunately, I'm afraid, describes maybe 50% of America. We have that group of people that have, so just for your audience, ACE are problems for the four-year-old to the 18-year-old, sort of the growing up years. And there's factors in you, in your life, that you can't control but are negative to developing your own self-esteem. When they were originally described, there were 10, and now it's grown quite larger. But in the old-fashioned days, so if you had a score of 3 or more of those, you were going to have very low self-esteem, lose all hope, and find difficulty crawling out of the barrel that you're in. So those that ACE was would be a divorced family, somebody doing drugs in the families, prenatal abuse, teenage pregnancy, somebody incarcerated. So if you're in an environment like that, it's very hard to crawl out of it. So there's two things that come from that. One is crabs in the barrel concept, which is a kissing cousin to the tall poppy syndrome. So if you're in that environment, and this has to do with family envy and your own growing up, I grew up in a family of 6 siblings. So there was a lot of competition within ourselves and our parents trying to keep everybody equal. And, you know, if somebody gets better, then somebody else may want to pull the crab back down. So the crabs in the bucket is that there's no need to have a lid on the bucket because the other crabs will pull each other down so that nobody escapes. And when you look at some of our low-income communities, that's certainly a big part of them. So when we look at the low self-esteem, we need more empathy towards that group and to understand the root problem and to try and solve that, not to denigrate that population. So the whole concept of being a bully bullying comes from the separation of power. So once again, the ACE group are going to be bullied. So they have a real problem in our society of gaining that self-esteem.
That very act, to me, kind of leans into another resulting effect, which is that experiential avoidance, you know, where as a result of those triggers interacting, one or the other individual in that equation leans into that notion, which we call experiential avoidance, where we then start to form some of those walls that push others out. There's a kind of dual contrasting view there today. I'm just mentioning that because it brings to mind.
Well, you're exactly right. So that puts that barrier up. The majority of them will put that barrier up and stay in that bucket. And then you have the others who change, the bad envy becomes anger. And then people have to remember that anger is a positive and a negative emotion too. So a good anger would be, I'm on the basketball court and somebody dribbles by me. And so you should think about, well, I'll practice my footwork so he's not going to do that again. Where the negative anger person just trips him or punches him or puts her arm out and fouls him when they go back. So that's the two phases of anger. And then the final phase, which is only about 10% of anger, is violence. But the bad envy turns into anger. Frequently, bad anger happens leading to violence. And then we've kind of really cut the tall poppy down when that happens, literally and figuratively, meaning frequently. Mm.
You know, I'm looking at that and it signals to me how we often have that tendency, not only in ourselves, to stereotype or characterize our own emotions, but also to outwardly then project that stereotyped and characterized view of others.
Well, I think the wonderful example of that was the Hillbilly Elegy written by Vance, who came from Appalachia. I mean, he had really a high A score if you looked at the background, his divorced family, his mother did drugs and eventually married again. And then that brought in more kids into the family. And they were low self-esteem children also with high A scores. And then Vance himself wanted to get out of that and that environment. Even though as a young kid, he figured out things weren't right. And the other kids kept pulling him back. They wanted to have him do break-ins and other negative things. And fortunately, he moved in with his grandmother, which changed his life, and then had the military and got into Ivy League schools and became an attorney. But then he got cut down again, even though he became successful, because he was sort of that deplorable class of people. And that he, even though he developed credentials, he still was who he originally was in many people's minds. So he kind of was a double whammy. He got out, but the affirmation wasn't there from America. When you look at the reviews of his book, it's about 50% positive and 50% negative. And I don't know how you can take such a wonderful story and somebody crawl out of that environment and become very successful in America and turn that into being a negative story.
It's a very interesting study for me in a lot of ways. I can relate to that, A, from the fact that his upbringing happened just a few short miles up the road from us. Very close relation. I have very common ties in that I have friends and fellow associates who also grew up in some of those very neighborhoods he grew up in. I also have that thread that ties of having family relations, family connections who grew up Eastern Kentucky, various other areas of Appalachia, and knowing firsthand some of those views that were thrust upon them as the hillbillies or having somewhat stigmatized views in who and what they are.
Yeah, I mean, when you just say the hillbilly word, once again, your envy's already on. You form that image of what you think the hillbillies are. And so it's very hard then to change that view that you have already created. And so we're not a very open book in that we give people a chance and then he might be in get into trouble or something happen and then it just reinforces your negative thoughts of that person. So it's very hard for that group to get the affirmation that you and I were talking about earlier, which we all want. Yeah. So rather than condemning those people, it was sad for me to read the book and not see people understand what was really happening and view that segment of society needing help, not condemnation.
That act of compassion is so essential and core to our coexistence together. There again, that stereotype and characterization of others becomes the limiting factor. You know, it's often a struggle for each of us to recognize the nuance and complexity within our own lives. It becomes an even greater task as we turn that lens towards others.
Yeah, that's the part of the crux of the problem. I mean, we're forming that judgment. We formed a very, from our own bad input, we formed a very negative opinion of them before we even knew anything about them. And then we confirm it by some of their actions, but instead of really reflecting on the situation, not the individual, but the situation that individual's in, we should arrive at, I need to do, you for me, one of the best things for our own affirmation is service to fellow man. So it's like we need to be empathetic instead of condemning and figuring out how we can try and help that person rather than condemn them. So that's part of the growing process, I think, when I wrote the book and figured out the cutter's motives, the egregious activity of the tall poppy who's cut down. So those are two things you're evaluating when you see an example of tall poppy syndrome in society. But in the end, you should grow the most because you then, you're looking through the window. And what you really need to do when you see that happen is look in the mirror and see your own part and who you really are and what part you are in that big picture. And you should grow from to look at how you interact with your peers to peers day to day, whether it's in your neighborhood, in your family, in your work, in the school system. It's all about real people relating to each other. And the tall poppy gives you really good emotional intelligence and can understand situations much better.
I think it's easy to realize that there is a very real element of that tall poppy syndrome where there are individuals who out of their own hurt, out of their own pain, out of their own lack of self-understanding, seek to bring others down. How, as we experience tall poppy, can we then turn that into more objective feedback for ourselves to grow and evolve?
That's really a good question. And I'll just use the bullying. When we grow up, I mean, most males, a lot of males felt, you know, bullying was a big part of their life. And it was a big part of my life and a big part of our family's life growing up with other kids in school. The problem is you develop those, your emotional being when you're young, you continue those through your life. And so it happens to the best of people, but just because you get cut down, it allows self-reflection. And maybe you see the wrong path that you took and you can correct that.
As we consider the events shaping our journey and how we begin to view them, there's so much value in recording that history now, in the present, while those you love are alive and capable of telling these stories. We often feel these narratives as creating our reality. By the same token, this perhaps often becoming motivated thinking. Evidence which simply proves the preconceptions of our own self-held personal biases. As we consider the role our social personas play in how we each view reality, perhaps we return then to Paul Harvey. The Paul Harvey Unofficial Archives has over 3,000 episodes of the rest of the story. It's unsure if every single episode that Paul produced has been saved. But for certain, it's pretty darn close. And it is perhaps in this light we end today with that famous signing off often utilized by Paul as a way of exuding our sense of curiosity, signaling the much which is yet to be discovered. And now you know the rest of the story. This has been The Light Inside. I'm Jeffrey Biesecker. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and follow us on social media at The Light Inside. We'll see you next week.